This podcast is brought to you by the Specialty Produce Network. The Specialty Produce app is the world's number one handheld resource on produce. The app features photographs, recipes, geography and history, taste and culinary applications on over 1,900 produce items. From apples to zapote, we've got your produce questions answered. Our app is available for both iPhone and Android. Download our app for free today.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Scout, the editor and curator behind the cultural lifestyle blog, Review by Scout, and welcome to my podcast, the smart, foxy, and curated roundtable for passionate women. Think of me as your cultural confidant. Let's get started, shall we? Hello, everybody. I'm Scout, your host and the curator behind the By Scout brand, which is a podcast, blog, and Instagram. Welcome to Podcast by Scout. This episode is going to be all about mental health. I have Ashton Harris here, who has suffered from an eating disorder since the sixth grade. So we're going to get into a lot of things about recovery, mental health, how to live with a mental illness. So I'm really excited. And so if any of you are listening who either suffer from an eating disorder or know someone who suffers from an eating disorder, hopefully this episode can shed a little bit of light. But before we get into our conversation, I wanted to check in real quick. If you can tell, my voice is extra raspy today since I went to Coachella this past weekend. I actually only made it to two of the days. I had to go home for day three because the festival was just a little bit too much for my anxiety. I had two panic attacks, one on night one and one the morning of day two. I actually was going to leave for day two, but I decided to rally and not let my anxiety get the best of me. And I think it's really difficult if you live with a mental illness to know where your limit stands and where you need to push yourself. And I did a lot of self-reflecting, and I realized that if I left early on day two, I would allow my anxiety to dictate my life. But my limit was that I could only go to day two and not day three. So I made that kind of executive decision and I rallied and I had a great time. I don't think I'll be going back to Coachella. I don't think it's necessarily all for me, but I had an amazing time with my sister, my sister's boyfriend, and my stepsister. And Beyonce was amazing as always. So I'm really happy I got to see her. I just posted a new blog post to reviewbyscout.com. That's reviewbyscout.com. It's called How Instagram Can Harm Your Mental Health. And it's just kind of a check-in. I have been pulling back on posting to Instagram the last 3 months because I've been suffering from a major depressive episode, along with suicidal ideation and voices in my head telling me to kill myself. So I kind of have been scaling back a little bit. I don't know if any of you have noticed or not, but I wrote a whole post about it. Just kind of checking in, letting you guys know where I stand with my bipolar disorder and how to engage in Instagram in a healthy, healthy way, because all too often we get really wrapped up in the facade and comparing one another. And so I kind of wanted to bring it back to the basics and use this place as a place to reflect strength and inspiration. So I'm happy to say that I'm getting out of my depressive episode right now and I'm ready to come back. And as I said earlier, reflect a place of strength and inspiration. So I'll leave my blog URL in the show notes for anyone that wants to go read that post. And one more thing. I've been promoting this on my podcast for the last few weeks, but I am hosting an event. It is called Haven by Scout, and it is a mental health panel on Sunday, May 6th at 2 p.m. I have a panel of incredible women. I have Kristen Smith, the founder of Saffron and Sage. If you want to learn more about her, check out episode number 14. I have Leah Kerpalani, the founder of ShopGood. And if you want to learn more about her, you can go to episode 27. And I have Amy Pomensky, founder of Nourished Balanced, who, you guessed it, was also on the podcast on episode 35. So it's just going to be really, really intimate. There's only 14 spots available and it's filling up quickly. So if you would like to attend, please shoot me an email at hello@reviewbyscout.com. That's hello@reviewbyscout.com. And of course, I will also leave that in the show notes. Okay, that was a mouthful. That was a lot, but I am ready to get into today's conversation. Today's guest is Ashton Harris. Ashton has suffered from an eating disorder which started in sixth grade. She is currently getting two master's degrees, one in social work and one in public health. All I can say about Ashton is I kind of feel like she's my mental health soul sister. We were introduced to each other by a mutual friend and we started texting nonstop and kind of just comparing tips, tricks, and being supportive of one another's mental health journey. And she's such a gem. So I'm going to let her do most of the explaining on who she is, why she's here, and how strong she truly is. So without further ado, Ashton Harris.
Oh, thank you, Scout. That was a very flattering introduction.
Don't you think we're mental health soul sisters?
Yes, I totally do. Because, I don't know, I just loved texting you. And I thought it was super cool that we were both able to just talk about stuff that people don't really feel that comfortable being open.
Yeah, we like skipped the intro phase and went straight to being like super comfortable with one another.
Super, super, super comfortable.
I like remember I hadn't even met you and I was like, hey, I'm suicidal. I can't hang out today.
Yeah, and I was like, it makes sense that you can't hang out today because that sounds like a terrible thing that you... clearly had the tools to set boundaries and say, okay, I'm not going to force myself to go, make this coffee date. I'm going to take care of myself, which is definitely what I'm all about as far as managing recovery and mental health.
Yeah. And I knew that you would understand. It's very hard to come by people who just like get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because there's a difference between, ditching on plans just because you're lazy and just don't want to get out of the house. But then there's there's when your anxiety, depression, or other features of your mental illness come out and you really have to
take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's jump right in. I've heard a little bit of this story, but I'm really excited to kind of dive in and hear more from your perspective and kind of pick out the stuff that's helped you recover. So when did you first start exhibiting eating disorder behavior?
So that's a really good question because I think it's most clear to look at when I was in sixth grade and I went into the bathroom after lunch and tried to make myself throw up. Mm-hmm. But so that's a very clear moment of eating disorder behavior. Mm-hmm. But I think that it kind of didn't happen, all at once. I moved from St. Louis to San Diego when I was 7 and I ended up skipping a grade and I had to make all new friends and it was a totally different social context. Everybody was older than me. I was just kind of overwhelmed. And for some reason in my head, the reason that I couldn't make friends, that I convinced myself that this was the reason I couldn't make friends was because I was fat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became obsessed with losing weight as an 8-year-old.
Oh my gosh.
So I would do Sugar Busters, which was this diet book that my mom had used when she was losing weight after she had my second brother. And so I would read it and be like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then I would make up my own, diet systems and nothing ever worked. Probably because I was 8 years old.
Yeah. Just that little bit of information there.
Yeah. And I was really busy trying to just be like a child. And I was so disappointed in myself all the time. I was like, I'm so fat. This is why I can't make friends. And so I was just like, okay, I'm going to try throwing up. And I had gotten the idea, ironically, sort of, because I was reading a book. It was called Nobody's Perfect, mm-hmm. and it was from one of those book fairs, where you get those, flimsy pieces of paper, and you can check off the books that you want to order. And it was kind of like a chicken soup for the teenage soul type of deal, where young women wrote stories of making it through adolescence. A lot of it was focused on body image and just kind of navigating the social context of adolescence. But really what I picked out of it was – you could have an eating disorder, and that's how you can get skinny and make friends, and your whole life is going to be together, which, I mean, that's like...
distorted.
Yeah, it's also to say the least. Most incorrect explanation of what it's like to experience and suffer with an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, that's what I got out of the book, and I started purging, and which is making yourself throw up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, my mom found me doing it, and she was really mad at me, which I understand now because sometimes people get angry when they're scared.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really scared that her daughter was, I mean, sticking her fingers down her throat.
It's scary.
That's a terrible thing to see.
Yeah.
So I was just really afraid of being in trouble. And so I tried to hide it as much as possible. And then in eighth grade, my middle school called my parents and said that I had been purging in the bathroom. And that was super horrible.
Yeah.
Because I think my parents were really upset that, you know, it had to come from the school, you know, that other people knew more about what was going on with me than they did. And so it was just very overwhelming. I went to therapy and I just felt like I was in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, I'll do whatever the therapist says. And that's kind of what's hard about trying to, you know, achieve recovery when you're, an adolescent. I was like 12 or 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just didn't want to be in trouble, but I was very much certain that I still needed to be as skinny as humanly possible. So I kind of just went to therapy, told the therapist what she wanted to hear. She said that I didn't have an eating disorder. And so I was like, okay, I don't have an eating disorder. And that's kind of how I carried on through to college.
I hate when, because I had a similar experience when I went to therapy when I was younger, they were like, you're not depressed, even though I ranked in the chronic to clinical zone of depression. But when you're an adolescent or a teenager, they just dismiss you. They really do.
Oh my God, it's so terrible.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's true that teens can be dramatic and their emotions are a lot more extreme than somebody with a fully formed like prefrontal cortex, that mm-hmm. whole, you know, area of our brain that makes us human for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that adolescents and young people aren't experiencing severe mental illness.
Yeah.
And it's super invalidating because then the rest of your life, you're like, okay, well, I'm not depressed. I can't be depressed. I mean, I felt like that. It was really hard for me when I was in college and just really, really sick. Like, mm-hmm. I needed to go to treatment. But I didn't believe that I had an eating disorder just because, I mean, for a number of different reasons. It's pretty common, actually, with eating disorders, people not thinking that they're sick enough mm-hmm. for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that was because I was told that I just had stress-induced vomiting.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So what was, when you got treatment, what did that look like?
So when I got treatment...
And what was the catalyst to getting treatment?
So I think the biggest catalyst to me getting treatment was my parents finding out that I had started self-harming, specifically by cutting. And that... I mean, understandably, it was super scary.
Yeah,
they had
no
idea. Because once again, I was really good at hiding it. It was like my life's greatest work was hiding everything, every dysfunction from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really sick, and the guy I was dating at the time told me, you need to get help, and if you don't, I don't know, like, how we're going to continue to date. And I was like, oh my God, I can't, I have to get help. I don't want to break up, and, you know, because I wasn't, like, a full person. So I told my parents that I needed to get a therapist. I just didn't want to do anything more complicated than just getting a therapist. And so I started seeing the therapist, and, she actually diagnosed me with depression and a clinical eating disorder. And I was so surprised because I was like, I am not skinny enough to have an eating disorder. I'm not sick enough. And I was super surprised that I was diagnosed with depression. But actually, that was super validating. That was one of the most validating experiences because I was like, oh, this feeling of like overwhelming dread and doom and exhaustion and whatever is not just me. It's mm-hmm. a condition that I have. So that was a really big deal. But my parents, they don't really look that good when I tell the story of like what was going on. They were like, when are you going to start winding down your sessions with your therapist? And I kind of lost it. I was like, Mom, Dad, I have a clinical diagnosed clinical eating disorder. It's not going to stop anytime soon.
It's hard for parents to accept.
Totally, because I mean,
they want it to be anything but, of course.
Totally, because so, you know, one of the things is that for a really long time, when eating disorders were first really coming about, you know, increasing in prevalence, and there was more awareness, or the psychological community was increasing awareness about anorexia and bulimia, it was parents were blamed for their children's eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my parents were really scared. They didn't want to be blamed because they did the best with the tools they had. They didn't know. And, you know, I think there's also a predisposition that I had to it biologically. So I think that was hard for them because they didn't want to feel guilt and shame.
Yeah, of course.
But I did really need to get help. So when they found that out, and then they also found out that I had been self-harming. They said, will you go to treatment at UCSD Eating Disorder Center? And I said, no. No, thank you. I'm fine. I don't, you know, for all of my
denial.
For all of my needing them to acknowledge me, I was also still in denial.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I kind of got to a point where I was so overwhelmed with everything. When you're not eating or when you're purging.
I was going to ask, are you doing both or one or the other?
I was doing both. Everything and anything, really. I wasn't so much a binge eater. I was like more of a subjective binge eater. It was kind of like, which is common too, where it's like you think that you've eaten an obscene amount.
Got it.
And you purge it. Or I was an over-exercising maniac. Mm. Like I would go to multiple classes a day and then go on the elliptical for like 1,000 hours.
Jeez.
You know those girls you see at the gym on the elliptical? That was me.
That was you.
Yeah, I always want to like give them like a card for National Eating Disorders Association online, you know, and just be like, you don't have to be like this. It doesn't have to be this terrible all the time.
That's
because
so good.
What I don't do it, but like I always wish I like guts to go do that. Because I think if somebody did that to me, I would be like, oh my God, that's actually like I feel seen. My whole life and my whole schedule was revolved around when I could work out. Even my classes in college, which is insane.
That's
because
crazy.
Who does that?
That's crazy.
I really like this spin class with this spin teacher, but this class that I need to take for credit is at the same. Come on, Ashton. Like, that's not.
That's not healthy.
That's a problem. That's when your priorities are so out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And also, something that was a really big thing was that I couldn't really make close connections with friends because it was so hard for me to go out to eat or do anything, which is just something that you do with mm-hmm. your friends. It's like, oh, let's go. And I was in school in LA, and so there were so many fun places to go. And I just couldn't do it because I needed to plan. I needed to be obsessive about it. And it just kind of it became so monopolized. It monopolized my entire ability to think and process. Mm-hmm. So if you look at my notes, I don't have my notes anymore from college because I threw them away, of course. But if you looked at my notebooks from this time, you could see that in the columns, they were just numbers of like, and that was just me adding up different combinations of things that I could eat that day, or like different options. So I was obsessively planning, and I just like needed to just have full control, but it was everything. It was everything on my mind. I couldn't think of anything else.
Mm-hmm. And so you said that you went to an intensive outpatient program. Mm-hmm. I've been to two of those. I'm wrapping up my second one right now. What was that experience like for you?
So I...
And can you describe what an intensive outpatient program is?
Yes. Okay. So I actually ended up going to the UCSD Eating Disorder Center because I lost...
That's ironic.
Yeah. Sometimes it happens that way. I kind of, came to the realization that I was so miserable and I just would have to let go. So I did. I did an intake evaluation, and they ended up putting me in the highest level of care, which I was super shocked, because I thought, once again, like, I'm not sick enough to have an eating disorder. But so I started off in what's called partial hospitalization.
Mm-hmm.
But then after maybe like 3 weeks, my insurance company decided that I didn't need intensive care anymore, and so I was dropped down to the IOP level, intensive outpatient program level, which meant that I would go into the program starting off 5 days a week for 4 hours a day, which would include one meal and one snack, because in eating disorder treatment, a lot of it is just being supervised while you eat meals. Yeah. And then processing emotionally afterward. So I ended up doing I ended up in IOP for a couple weeks until my insurance company dropped me again,
mm-hmm.
Which was really frustrating and really scary because I'd finally like gotten a hold of that desire to recover and not be sick, and then mm-hmm. my insurance company was like, "Okay, well, we think you're fine now."
Ugh, so, that's the worst.
Yeah, I mean, insurance for mental health sucks.
I've been pretty lucky with my IOP program. They've not only did they cover first 15 days, they were able to get me 10 more days on top of that.
That's really good.
So I've had nightmare insurance problems, but for this round of IOP, yeah, they did pretty good for me.
Yeah, I think that it'll start to get better, especially as there are some policies, like the Affordable Care Act mandates that mandates certain parity laws, or mandates that insurance cover certain mental health treatment.
That's amazing.
Yeah, which is really great, especially considering the like substance use disorders mm-hmm. that are exploding in America.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So what does your recovery look like today?
My recovery looks okay. So that's a really good question because it's kind of changed and looked differently as I get older and have different experiences. So I after I went to UCSD treatment, I went back to school and I was doing great. I studied abroad, fully relapsed. Was really intense. And I came back and I went back into IOP and I still was, kind of in a relapse. And what ended up happening is I ended up going to trauma therapy for sexual assault. And it's almost like that was kind of not the last piece of the puzzle, because I'm always working on recovery, but it was definitely something that was holding me back, was trauma. So my recovery now involves a lot of, taking self-inventory and a lot of self-awareness, and And I'm working on intuitive eating, which is so hard.
Yeah, that's very difficult.
Yeah, because ideally, so my dream would be to just eat what I want when I want and not freak out about it and to fully trust my body. So I would say that my direction in recovery right now is learning to trust my body, that my body mm-hmm. knows what to do with the food that I provide it, and it's going to give me the right signals. Because when you have an eating disorder, oftentimes you lose the ability to, respond to your body's hunger cues or even feel hunger cues. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you lose the ability to taste food.
Wow. Yeah. I know, that's crazy.
Yeah. A lot of the people with really severe anorexia in treatment had a hard time tasting food. They were slowly starting to really taste it again, which is an interesting phenomenon. But so I would say I'm definitely working on that intuitive eating mm-hmm. piece. But it's a huge challenge.
Well, it's such an interesting monster to tackle because, like, if you're a drug addict, then you don't do drugs anymore. And that's very clear cut. Not that it's any easier by any means. But when you have an eating disorder, you have to still eat. So it's so it's difficult. I can only imagine to be able to control something that you have to go through every day.
Exactly. Yes. You put it perfectly, Scout. That was like,
thank you.
Exactly. it's frustrating because it's something that you have to face mm-hmm. multiple times a day. Mm-hmm. And also it's not like the world we live in is super normal about food, right? We've been getting messages for forever that about like being good and being bad. The idea of like being good and being bad in regards to what you eat is so asinine, I think.
Detrimental.
Because food is like, is an inanimate object. It's not inherently moral or immoral, and the choices that you make are yours and personal. If you eat one thing versus another thing, it doesn't mean you're good. Or if you eat a donut, you're bad. It has nothing to do with who you are as a person.
That's so true. I suffer with that a little bit. That's so true. I've never heard anybody kind of explain it in that way. I like that a lot.
Well, it gives food a lot of power.
Well, there's also this foodie culture that is just through the roof. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I love a good meal out. My husband and I are huge foodies. But the fact that's like when I had to scale back on eating a little bit because I was gaining weight and I was getting a little obsessive over it. It was like, well, I want ramen, In-N-Out, Italian food mm-hmm. and Thai food. So do I have to like space these out? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like we go crazy with the food that's out there.
Right. And I think that what intuitive eating looks like or will look like for me, mm-hmm. hopefully if I like practice and get better at it, it's being able to listen to my body's signals. And because it's not just a matter of like gaining weight or losing weight or like, mm-hmm. you know, caloric deficiency or excess. Because if you are really good at listening to what your body wants, you're going to crave the nutrients that your body needs too. And you're going to learn how to pay attention to the way that you feel after you eat versus, so, you know, in the past when I would eat and feel regret, I had no idea how my body felt.
Interesting.
This is actually very common in eating disorders is like not having awareness of your bodily sensations. Mm-hmm. So I would have a headache for like a whole day and not realize that I was in a bad mood because I had a headache all day. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. But, you know, when you eat and you feel uncomfortably full, I would immediately go to, I suck, shame, mm-hmm. guilt. Mm-hmm. And not like, maybe my stomach hurts because I ate too fast, or, you know, maybe that amount wasn't good, or maybe that type of food doesn't agree with me.
Yeah.
And I've actually gotten so much better at this, which is amazing. Because I always thought that I was just a not sensitive person.
That's awesome.
But I've learned that, you know, certain food doesn't make me feel good, and certain food does make me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, you know, sometimes I'll be like, my body really needs a vegetable. Like, I really need to eat a vegetable.
I remember you texted me that. You're like, I need a fucking vegetable.
Yes, I need, yeah. I needed a fucking vegetable.
That's
because
amazing.
I was, I don't know. It's hard to eat vegetables.
Yeah, I love veggies.
I love veggies, but also they're kind of a lot of work.
Yeah, because you have to, like, really cook them.
Well, yeah, because I'm writing a thesis, and it's the worst thing in the world. It's taking up all my time.
I want to talk about your thesis and what you're studying about. Will you tell everybody a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm very much excited about it. It's only thing is it's taking forever, but...
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's really cool. So I wanted to look at the way that people access food and how that influences their dieting behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So my philosophy is that dieting is disordered eating, which, you know, a lot of eating disordered experts will agree with. And
mm-hmm.
so would the National Eating Disorders Association, all those groups. But so what I did is I got a national sample, like a nationally representative sample. And I looked at people with food insecurity. So they have a lack of access to consistent, fresh, healthy, adequate food.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked at if that impacted or changed the way that they dieted. And what I found was that people who experienced food insecurity were significantly more likely to use laxatives and vomiting to lose weight, to start smoking to lose weight, and skipping meals to lose weight, among other things. So just like eating pathology or disordered eating in general was higher among people who had marginal low or very low food security versus people who had full food security, which is interesting because people assume that disordered eating, chronic dieting, and eating disorders are exclusive to wealthy white women, which is not the case at all.
I think that's a lot of mental health, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And my belief is that... that's a huge disservice to, people who suffer with disordered eating and eating disorders, because even, you know, there's like that internal, stereotyping, like I look a certain way and I'm from a certain background, so I can't have an eating disorder. That's for rich white ladies,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
But it's not the case. And I think that if there's a population of people who are not only suffering from a lack of access to adequate food, like how awful would it be to also be experiencing stress about,
mm-hmm.
you know, weight loss and food, because people with food insecurity are more likely to be overweight and obese.
Hmm.
Partially because of a lack of access to to vegetables, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because
yeah.
vegetables are harder to, they don't last as long as canned or processed foods. You have to prepare them. That takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a challenge. And then not to mention nobody is immune to body shame unless you work really, really hard
mm-hmm.
against it. So, people every day, especially if you're overweight or obese, are getting told by people who had no idea about their actual health status
mm-hmm.
that they need to lose weight, that they can't, they'll go to doctor's offices. Doctors statistically will spend less time with obese persons and ascribe all health ailments to obesity when they could have nothing to do with a person's weight.
Yeah.
Person's weight has nothing to, not, I mean, it depends, but person's weight is not an accurate indicator of their overall health.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is so important to know.
Okay, so wait, this is all your thesis?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're getting a master's.
Yeah, so I'm getting, yeah, I'm getting two master's degrees.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. I'm so excited to be finished.
So what's like your dream kind of position afterwards, once you're done?
So my dream position is probably, well, not probably, definitely to be a clinical director of a mental health nonprofit. Specifically, I really want to focus on low-income women who've experienced trauma, especially sexual trauma, who have an array of mental health issues, mm-hmm, mental mm-hmm. illnesses, because I think that women face a lot of stigma already.
Yeah.
And it's just so important that we help people process trauma. I mean, just because you have access, I guess what I'm saying is, I think that people need to be able to access trauma therapy who can't afford it.
Amen.
Because how are we supposed to, it was one of the biggest things in me recovering from my eating disorder was addressing some of the trauma that I had faced in my life that was mm-hmm. just kind of like, I wasn't like fully aware of it or what it did to me. Processing the trauma was life changing.
Yeah,
it changed the way that I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people really need access to that.
You're so admirable.
Thank you.
It's so badass. I love it.
Well, the thing is, it's not because I like want to. It's not that I want to like. I mean, I do want to help people, but it's also because it frustrates me. Like, yeah. I just get very, very frustrated mm-hmm. that so many elements of mental health and well-being are ignored or not considered.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
It doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, I think that's awesome, that direction that you're going in. I think it's really admirable for sure.
I think that it will, like, I don't know, I especially with this, you know, the opioid crisis, a lot of women, so I'm full of, like, facts and figures because I'm a big nerd, but so most women who are, I think it's almost like 100% of women who are addicted to heroin or opioids, especially if they're using a needle, were introduced to the substance from a male partner.
Hmm.
Or by a male partner, I mean, and almost all women with severe substance use disorders have experienced some sort of trauma, and a lot of that is sexual trauma.
Yeah, it's very true.
And there, you know, we have evidence-based treatment to help people recover from that. And if we want to make a dent in this, like, opioid and addiction crisis, then we really have to consider the people suffering, not just the drug.
You're going to change some lives for sure. You really are. I mean, the work you're doing is so, so incredible. So I'm stoked to see kind of where this takes you after your thesis.
Thank you.
Okay, so what has been the most challenging thing about your eating disorder?
The most challenging thing is body image, mm. for sure. They say that that's the last to go, and some days are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Body image is a fickle motherfucker. Like,
yeah,
it's like,
a bitch.
Sucks, you know?
I mean, if pretty much everybody deals with body image on some level, I can't imagine what that level would be like if one had a disorder.
Yeah, because what it feels like is like, there will be times when I look in the mirror and I think that, like, it's much less frequent now, but looking in the mirror and based off of the way my body looks, like, judging myself as a complete person just based off of my appearance, which is a thing that a lot of women do. I'm not unique in that. But it sucks because what feels really good is using my behaviors, like eating disorder behaviors. That solves those feelings, but only temporarily, because then they just get worse.
Yeah.
So I think it's a lot of the biggest challenge is working on my body image, which is a consistent thing that I have to do all the time.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Okay. So on the flip side, what's been the most rewarding aspect of your recovery?
I have to say 100% being able to make better connections with people. I was very isolative when I was sick. I couldn't go out to eat with people because, you know, like, how am I supposed to either not eat or like secretly go off and purge, which was, I hated doing that because it just made me feel more alone. But since going through recovery, I have been actually pretty vocal about, because I think that's been helpful for me in recovery, is kind of speaking out about it. When I got out of treatment for the first time, when I got back to school, I gave a whole speech to my organization on campus and kind of said, okay, let's set up a culture of body positivity in our organization. And so ever since that, and ever since going through recovery and being outspoken about it, I've made a lot of really great connections with people. And those connections aren't necessarily just about my eating disorder, because going through recovery has made me more confident in myself and more relaxed and less isolative. So I've been able to make friends and have relationships with people.
That's awesome. Okay, so what do you do to stay healthy today?
To stay healthy today? That's a really good question, because my thesis makes me feel like an insane person. there are times when I'm like, okay, Ashton, you can't, this isn't college anymore. You have to sleep. So sleep, major
for me too. It's one of my triggers.
Oh yeah. Not getting sleep makes me so much more emotionally labile. I have a way lower distress tolerance when I don't sleep. Eating 3 meals a day is something that I do. I mean, that I really have to keep track of for recovery. What else? I'm trying to think. What do I do for recovery? That was a question, right?
Yeah. Okay. What do you do to stay healthy?
I also, exercising too. Exercising not to lose weight or to burn calories, but to
mental
move my
relief.
Body. Yeah. And like have endorphins.
Yeah, totally.
Endorphins make people happy.
That's why I'm going to work out after.
Happy people don't kill their husbands.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you got to finish that quote real quick.
I know. yeah, that's why you're going after.
Yeah, I'm going to work out after. I really fucking don't want to.
No,
but I'm doing it for my mental health.
Yeah, well, especially because you're going to spin class. The first, like, 10 minutes of a spin class.
See,
or 15.
I am so out of shape, but for some reason, I love a good spin class.
Well, sometimes after a good spin class, I feel like I can conquer the entire world.
I know, right? It's
and
so
I'm like
empowering.
A fitness girl, and I'm like ready.
I'm in
doing
shape.
It. Yes, I'm such a bad, because, oh my God, have you ever cried in a spin class before?
No, but I've cried in a yoga class.
I cried in a spin class once because the music was so inspiring. I don't know what happened, and I was like, oh God. Crying?
You heard it here first.
it's a thing that apparently happened.
That is so funny.
I know.
I love that.
I know.
Okay, so let's say someone's listening and they're suffering. What would you like to say to them?
Well, I would first of all say that there's no such thing as sick enough to get treatment. No such thing. If you are not sick enough, like I said, that's not a thing, but be grateful. I know it's so hard to think that, because when you're in an eating disorder, all you want to do is be sick. You know, your logic is totally messed up, but just get help. Mm-hmm. And that's really easy for me to say, but I would say start by going to nationaleatingdisordersassociation.org and do a screening assessment to see if you might have an eating disorder. And that can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. And then look at those resources because NEDA, National Eating Disorders Association. NEDA only, you know, shows or like provides resources that are evidence-based. I'm really a big fan of evidence-based anything. Don't waste your time on something that's not effective and that's kind of like emotionally draining but not moving you anywhere. Mm-hmm. So with eating disorders, a lot of the time it doesn't really help at first to talk about all of the relationships and maybe what caused the eating disorder. The most important thing is to you know, work on your eating and get your, because you can't do therapy when your brain isn't being fed.
Yeah.
Regardless of if you're binge eating, if you're binging and purging, if you're restricting, whatever type of disordered eating you have or eating disorder, you can't, make effective progress if you're not nourishing yourself. So another thing is you can go to a registered dietitian who specializes in eating disorders. Make sure it's not a nutritionist, but a registered dietitian. And I would stay off of nutrition blogs.
Bold statement.
Not,
but I like it.
Not like I, you know, because there are some really great nutrition blogs, but when you're experiencing an eating disorder, it's really important that you get your,
information.
Yeah. You get your nutrition. I don't know how to explain it. You get nutritionally stabilized. Mm-hmm. And nutrition blogs can be super triggering. You can definitely come back to your favorite nutrition blogs, especially if they make really great healthy foods that will make you feel really great in your recovery.
Yeah.
But at first, it's really important to learn
from
how to eat. Yeah.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I had no idea how to eat. I didn't know that I deserved to have 3 meals a day. I thought that like skinny people didn't eat at all.
Girl, you deserve more than 3 meals a day. I deserve like 5, just saying.
Yeah, and snacks.
And snacks, yeah, snacks. And dessert, you know.
Oh my God. Frozen yogurt. I have a frozen yogurt meal.
Yeah.
I love frozen yogurt.
Yeah, me too. It's so good. Have you tried Press Juicery?
No, I haven't.
Okay, go to fucking UTC. Do you want to know what they did?
What'd they do?
They made juice, and they were like, what would happen if we threw this in a frozen yogurt machine? It's frozen yogurt juice, and it's so good. And you get almond butter on top.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, that's
should we go together?
Yes.
One of us. Okay. By the way, we also live down the street.
I know.
It's awesome. We should take one car and go get Press Juicery one day.
Oh, I would die.
That's our next date.
Yeah.
Okay, so let everyone know. Well, you don't have an Instagram because you are insanely smart.
Oh, that's another thing. Yeah, that's another thing. Is take a break from triggering
content.
That's basically what I mean when I say like nutrition blogs.
Yeah,
if there's like bloggers who you know that trigger you and you're, you know, that they kind of like their recipes fit into your specific disordered eating patterns, try and take a break from those.
Yeah. I took a break for 3 months, pretty much. I was in a little bit, but mostly out.
And then you can go back and have like better
perspective,
and you can say, okay, I can incorporate these recipes and this blogger's like, you know, really cool content into my life, but I don't have to be obsessively like, you know, I don't have to make my life look perfect.
Yeah,
or my eating perfect. There's no such thing as perfect eating.
Perfect and perfect anything.
Yeah
I love that.
And I also love, I mean, Review by Scout's very positive. If you're looking for like a something to fill your time,
don't take a break from me. No, just
don't
kidding.
Take a break from Scout. No, it also really, it's like look for content that makes you feel proud of yourself.
Yeah, that's a very good tip.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe it's if someone wants to email you to chat more.
Yes, definitely.
Where can they email you?
e.ashtonharris@gmail.com. So it's e like as in email dot a s h t tonhariris at gmail.com.
And we'll put that in the show notes for anyone. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scout. That was so fun.
Yeah, this was awesome. Yes. Okay, for more things Scout, you can follow me on Instagram at by.scout. That's by.scout. It's linked in the show notes. And you can check out my cultural lifestyle blog, reviewbyscout.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to subscribe, rate, review, comment on iTunes. This helps me create episode after episode. I will catch you later. But before I go, here is the quote of the week from Albus Dumbledore from Harry Potter. Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times if one only remembers to turn on the light. With that, farewell and adieu.